I ask you to turn your Bibles this morning to Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13. We continue our study in the last chapter of our study of the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 13. I'm going to be looking this morning at verses 5 and 6. Verses 5 and 6. Verse 5 says, "Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, 'I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you,' so that we confidently say, 'The Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?'" Back in 2007, I think it was, I read this recently, 2007, the U.S. Mint came out with a dollar coin, and on that coin, what was missing on that coin was "In God We Trust." And it was they were very apologetic. It was a mistake. They said it was an oversight, and they wanted to correct it, and I assume it's all been corrected. I know atheists are still trying to do this, but this is in 2007. But my point is, that coin got distributed, and conspiratists, of course, said it was a conspiracy, but, you know, I don't know any of that. That's not my point. My point is this. It said, it didn't say, "In God we trust" on it. And they called it the godless coin. That's what it became known as, the godless coin. But what I want to say to you this morning is I think that coin reflects probably more the truth about us than our coins that say it on there. You follow me? I think our tendency is to trust the coin more than God. I think that's a true statement. I think that's what the author of Hebrews is really seeking to get at the heart of this morning. I don't think it's just about money. I think it's about loving, wanting, and craving. It's much deeper than just money. Money's neutral. But it's an issue of the heart. It's an issue of desire. Love of something. And that's what I want to address this morning, because he talks about this as one of the issues in Hebrews 13, one of his concluding issues, one of his concluding exhortations to this group of Hebrew believers. As he has finished 12 chapters of doctrine, he says, "Now this is your duty. This is how it all applies. This is what you're to do with it. This is how you're to live it out." He said at the end of chapter 12, you'll remember this, "Therefore, since," verse 28 of chapter 12, "Therefore, since we received a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service." See that? As a Christian, I offer service to God. As a Christian, I'm Romans 12, 1. I present my body a living and holy sacrifice to God. That's the therefore of Romans. After all the doctrine in Romans, therefore, present your body a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God. It's the duty. I've got all the doctrine. This is the duty based on all this doctrine, all this truth. That's what empowers me to do it, gives me the strength to do any of it. It would be legalism if you didn't tell me the why. But because of Christ and the person and the work of Christ and all that he has done and the access that he gives me into the very presence of God that Hebrews has taught us, there are certain things that I respond and ways I respond. And we've seen that as we've come into the 13th chapter of the book of Hebrews. "Let the love of the brethren continue." Verse 1, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers." This love strangers, love people you don't know. Remember prisoners who are suffering for the sake of the gospel in parts of the world. Love your wife, love your husband in marriage. Don't settle for false love, which is sexual immorality we talked about last week. And don't love money. Be content. You see that today. Jesus said a lot about money. It's interesting, if you were to look at the 38 parables, 16 of them were on how we are to handle money. See, this is unrighteous mammon. It's not holy. Money is all moral. And that's nothing good or bad about it. It's not. And how we handle that is an indication of our heart. And so Jesus in the parables points that out over and over again. How you handle the material things is an indication of the heart. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. Where your treasure goes, that's where your heart goes. 38 parables, 16 of them are on how we handle money. One out of every 10 verses in the Gospels deal with that subject. He says 500 verses on prayer, 500, not quite 500 verses on faith, and 2,000 verses on money throughout the Bible. So it's important. But money isn't just the issue. It's the love of. It's the heart. You speak to an American audience, this isn't a popular subject in an American audience. It's not a popular subject in any audience because we all have this kind of heart, but especially in a society that is so prone to materialism, especially in a society that we all face the struggle in. We have so much, and it's hard not to trust in what we have and want more. That's what covetousness is, the word. Covetousness. Desire. Wanting something I do not have, or wanting more of something that I do have. Wanting more. It's a desire. Desire in itself is not wrong. There's some good desires. But it's when it becomes an inordinate desire, a controlling desire, wanting it too much, to where it becomes an idol to me almost and controls me. That's what he's talking about here. That's what he's talking about. It's not something that's talked about. Everyone would agree, sexual immorality we talked about last week was wrong. The things we talked about were wrong. Everyone would pretty much agree with that. But when you get to the subject of covetousness, you don't hear much about it. It deals with greed. It deals with craving. It deals with a strong desire of wanting something, like I said earlier. But you don't hear many sermons on it. Spurgeon said in one of his 19th century sermons, he said, people have confessed a lot of sins to me over the years and told me things they've done wrong, but he said, I've never heard anybody say they covet. I've never heard anybody say that. And yet it's listed in 1st, you don't have to turn there, but listen to this. In 1 Corinthians 5, Paul, speaking to the Corinthians, says, I wrote you in my last letter not to associate with immoral people, speaking primarily of so-called brothers who are immoral or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard, and he goes on. So we don't talk about it because it's kind of a hidden sin. It's in the heart type of sin. I can look at the other 9 commandments and they're kind of external, though there is a motivation behind them, though there is more to them. It would be easy for somebody like the Apostle Paul, for example, to say, well, I didn't commit adultery. Well, I didn't steal. Well, I didn't lie. Well, I honored my parents. Well, I honored the Sabbath. He could go down the list and say, I did all that. But Paul says in Romans 7, then I saw this covetous thing. And that condemned me. I realized then I was a sinner. The law, and the reason I realized it was the law spoke of it. The law said that's a sin. The law exposed me. He's giving a defense there why the law is good. But this is one that is in the heart. And you look at religious television programs. Somebody was interviewing me this past week on prosperity gospel, prosperity theology, and we talked about this. We talked about the fact that many religious television programs appeal to this in their listeners. They appeal to greed. It's God is a genie, and he will give you what you want. He will give you your best life now. He will give you all of these things that will give you success in life, health, wealth, and prosperity, all that the world has to offer. But that's what God does for you. That's the kind of God we have, they say, who will do those kinds of things for you. And they promote this in us that appeals to us. False teachers, Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 5, he says, the false teachers are guilty of supposing that godliness is a means of great gain. And the point is, financially, gain. It does. It appeals because they're appealing to their own flesh. Because that's inside of us. So, the Bible does teach us that the attitude, it's what I'm talking about this morning is attitude and how we look at money. How we look at money is a test. It's a test. It really is a test for us. A test of our devotion to God. It reveals something about our heart. Because where your treasure is, there's your heart will be. What you value, what's important to you, what your priority is, your heart will reveal that about you. Just in time for Christmas, just in time for Black Friday. Isn't this perfect? We all struggle with this. We all struggle with this, right? We all do. I've heard that believers in other parts of the world pray for us that we will respond wisely and biblically to our material prosperity. They don't worry about it from that angle. They got other issues, but this one they recognize is a problem of our culture and other cultures, but very much so in the culture in which we live. Who do you trust in when you're in trouble? See, that's the question. When you're in trouble, what do you trust in? This is a revealer of the heart. What do you trust in? How do you react when others have something or have more than you have? How do you react? What is your greatest treasure? It's interesting, he says in 13:5, make your character free from the love of money. You will find that statement actually also in the qualifications of a church leader, which really contradicts so many of the false teachers who promote this. Money. But your character is to be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. Turn to Luke 18. Let me show you two responses here in Luke 18 to money. Kind of get us started here. In Luke 18, this is the rich young ruler. You're familiar with this story in the Bible. This event that took place in the ministry of Christ, where this ruler came up to him and questioned him, verse 18 of chapter 18, Luke 18, 18, saying, good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? So he's asking a question. You know, a lot of people don't ask you this openly, but this man asked Jesus, and Jesus tells him some things. Well, you know, the law, what's the law say? And he tells Jesus he does all that, which you know is a lie, but he thinks he does all that. It's interesting. He thought, just like any Pharisee would have thought, I got the externals down. I don't do any of those things. Then Jesus hits him with this statement. When Jesus heard this in verse 22, one thing you still lack. See all that you possess and sell all that you possess and distribute it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. But when he heard these things, he became very sad, for he was extremely rich. See that? Jesus exposed covetousness. Jesus exposed an idol in his heart. He didn't treasure Jesus. He didn't value Jesus. He wanted Jesus on his own terms, but he certainly wasn't going to give anything that he had. See, that's one response to money. That's one thing that money does. It can grieve you. It grieved this man. It can have such a hold. And it's not the money. It's the love of it. It's got a hold. Go to Luke 19 and compare it with this response. In Luke 19, we meet Zacchaeus, who is a chief tax collector. Now, let me tell you something. This guy is super rich. He had other tax collectors working underneath him, and they were making him rich into some huge pyramid scheme. I mean, it was ridiculous. He was rich. And I guarantee you, if Jesus would have asked him the question, did you keep all the Ten Commandments, he would have been saying, hey, I'm a tax collector. Speaks for itself. But notice, he's up in the tree, you know that. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house. He came down gladly. He received him gladly. Go to verse 8. Zacchaeus stopped and said, hey, Lord, Lord, behold, half of my possessions I will give to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone of anything, and I guarantee you he had, I will give back four times as much. See this attitude toward money? I mean, something has happened in this guy's heart. And see, that's the joy. See, money is a neutral thing. It's the heart. It can be a very useful thing. Very useful. Very, very much given with joy. There's just a gratitude here that's expressed in what Zacchaeus does. All right, let me talk about money for a bit this morning. Let me just say a few things about it. One, is it evil? No, money is not evil. Possessions are not evil. Turn to 1 Timothy 6. I'm going to have you turn to a few of these and just stay there because it's too many verses. I'm just going to read most of them. But 1 Timothy 6, you've seen this. 1 Timothy 6. In 1 Timothy 6, you see this is the verse Paul refers to. In the context of false teachers in previous verses, telling people in the context of how they are to behave in the household of God, that's what 1 Timothy is about. He says, for the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, all kinds of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So, notice it says the love of money is the root to all evil, or is a root of all evil. It doesn't, all sorts of evil, doesn't say money itself is evil. It's neutral. Listen to this verse. I said something about this earlier. Luke 16, 11. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, money, neutral, righteous, not unrighteous, either one. But if you have not been faithful with unrighteous wealth, how is God going to entrust true riches to you, spiritual riches to you? So money, God uses money in our life to develop our faith, develop our trust. How we deal with it reveals our heart. It tests us on our priorities at times. We get out of balance, but it tests us. What are you trusting in? What are you looking to? What are you wanting? So God uses it. He wants you to be faithful with that unrighteous mammon, he calls it, or unrighteous wealth, because it's an indicator of where your heart is. So he wants to bless you with true riches. 1 Timothy 5:8, go up to verse 8 of chapter 5 in 1 Timothy where you're at right now. Money has various responsibilities. Notice in verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied his faith, the faith, and is worse than an unbeliever. Listen, money is to meet needs. Money is to provide for your family. It's to provide for the needs that you have. So it has responsibility. It helps with various responsibilities. If you don't work, you don't eat, Paul says in 1 Thessalonians. I mean, it has a role, but it's neutral. It's not evil. It's the attitude towards it that's the issue in Hebrews 13. Stay there in 1 Timothy 6. How is loving money harmful? Let's ask that question. Look in verse 9 again. Go to verse 9 of 1 Timothy 6. 1 Timothy 6, verse 9. I didn't have you look there yet. Verse 9. But those who want to get rich, those who crave getting rich, those who strongly desire to get rich, fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires, which the word plunge is interesting. It means to submerge. It's the idea of a ship being pulled to the bottom of the sea. Some people get pulled way down by it. They do. Get pulled down to ruin and destruction. Verse 10 says, some people have wandered away from the faith. It can lead to apostasy. Demas, who used to be with me, has now left me because he loves the world. Judas, the world, money, apostasy. The parable of the soils, can the weeds, which are money and material things, can choke out the word. This is answering the question, how is loving money harmful? This is how it's harmful. It can choke it. These are things it can do. If you think of the other 10 commandments, think of idol worship. You can break that commandment by loving money, because now you've put an idol between you and God, money or things. Think of lying. Some people will lie to get more money. They love money and they will lie. They will cheat on their income taxes or business account. I don't know. They'll cheat somehow to get it because they love it so much. And steal. Adultery. And you think about it, some people will work and work and work and work to accumulate more money and neglect their family and neglect their home, and they end up in divorce, and they have no marriage anymore. They have a lot of money to fight over. That's what they got. They don't have a marriage anymore because the pursuit of money. I mean, you could just look at how the other commandments are affected by covetousness, by wanting and desiring something so strongly, making an idol out of it in your heart. Another reason it's harmful is because of this. Listen to this, 23:5 of Proverbs. You don't have to turn there, but 23:5 of Proverbs. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. No security in it. It's gone. Did you hear about the guy in West Virginia? He's got a website. In fact, there's a website of all the former lottery winners. No, excuse me, some of the former lottery winners, not all of them. But some of the former lottery winners, they won tons of money. And some of their comments are things like, I wish I had never won it. It has just brought me grief and heartache. And he's bankrupt. I don't know how you spend that much money. But the point is, I got my idol, and it just didn't do it. I lost my marriage. I wanted to commit suicide. It's created all kinds of tension in my relatives and everyone. I mean, I wish I had never seen it. It just doesn't last. Ecclesiastes 5:10 says, he who loves money, notice, will not be satisfied with money. That's our word contentment. Will not be content with money. He who loves money will not be content with money. And that's the richest man in the world who's ever lived saying that. That's Solomon. He calls it vanity, empty, an empty pursuit. Rockefeller, who was a very, very wealthy man early on, and as were many others, but he made an interesting quote. Somebody asked him, so when are you going to ever be satisfied? When you ever got enough? And what's enough? And he goes, just a little bit more. Just a little bit more. It just doesn't satisfy. Doesn't satisfy. Think about this too. Think about these get-rich-quick schemes. These people that come on TV sometimes and tell you, hey, listen, you will never have to leave your house with this job. You will, no skill required. This is amazing. You never have to break a sweat. You never have to hassle with being around people. Oh my. But you're going to get rich. Oh, you're going to get rich. Buy my tape, buy my video, buy my whatever, and listen to my secret formula for how to do this. See, when people love money, they really fall for these schemes. Greed, just, these people know this, and they advertise that way, and they know how to appeal to something in us. Let me just read you a couple of verses. You don't have to turn to all these. This is a good one to write down, though, and go back to. He who tills the land will have plenty of food. He who tills the land will have plenty of food. He who works will have plenty of food. But he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty and plenty. A faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. See, God's designed it that way. God's designed it. The way you gain wealth is that you offer something of value, whether it's labor, a skill, or a product, in exchange for money. It's value for value, right? Working hard, gaining skill, reward is rewarded with a return value. That's how God's designed it. And I don't want to take the time to read this whole, but this is a great proverb. Proverbs 6, go watch how the ant works. That's how you do it. Proverbs 6, 6 through 11. Oh, go to the ant, you sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise. And it just talks about how hardworking the ant is. Oh, come on. We got to get that low to the ground to figure out how to do this. That it doesn't work with all these. That it's not going to take hard work. They promise easy money, and some people, because they want so much and greed so much, and they promise all your financial problems will be over. There's no risk. You know, I've been around and heard some men talk like this sometimes, and I'm sure it's got to scare their families sometimes, but when you're always looking for the next big scheme, the next big thing out there, the next shortcut to wealth. I just say to you, that's pride. That's pride. If you want to do that as a hobby, great. But work at Walmart if you have to, but provide for your family. Provide for your family. Work wherever. Provide for your family. That is noble, to provide for your family. I admire men who will do jobs. You know they're not totally fulfilled in the work, but they have one priority, and that is I'm going to provide for my family, because that is the priority. It's not waiting for the next big scheme. Maybe just work here or work there until that comes, but work. Too many times I've heard and listened to and seen families go into financial ruin because the husband's waiting for the right job, or he won't stay in a job or something like that, because it's just whatever. It's not biblical. It's not biblical. It takes hard work, and you always don't like your job. It doesn't matter all the time. Only in America do you get self-actualization in your work. I mean, some of the people in the world are just, you're born on the farm, you stay on the farm, you die on the farm. We get choices, and we're miserable with all the choices. We don't know what to do with them. We're afraid we'll miss something. The reality is, you know how you please God? You provide for your own. You don't jump at every scheme that comes along. That's just your greed being appealed to. that guy with the video series or DVD series or whatever, he knows what's in your heart. He knows how to get you. He knows what's in my heart. I'll tell you another thing that's gotten really big is gambling. Gambling. I don't know that I could go to take you to a verse in the Bible that would tell you that all gambling is wrong. I mean, I do the Monopoly scratch off at McDonald's, okay? You know, so I mean, I'm not going to tell you don't go to McDonald's and do their little. You know, I'm not going to say every. I can't find a verse that would say that. But what I can tell you is, what you might want to just say is something fun to do. Just always beware that you got a covetous heart, and what you start out as something fun to do might one day take a huge hold on you. All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. We're not to be mastered by anything, right? And I tell you what, gambling is amazing how it's so quick. I see people at Starbucks sometimes. I see people in different places, and I just gambling online. It is so easy and addictive. I hear it's really rampant among college students who have no money, and their parents are probably going bankrupt. But I mean, it's ridiculous. And once again, what's the appeal to the greed? To our greed, to our wanting more. No work involved, no nothing. This is a quick way to do it. But, and like I said, I'm not saying everything is wrong on it. I don't have a verse, but I do know greed and coveting is wrong. And when that's driving me and motivating me, that's sinful. And that can turn into enslavement. See, that's what's at the root of sexual immorality, is wanting that leads to enslavement. Same thing with love of money and material things. All right, let's talk about learning to be content, okay? Let's look at the second part of that verse. 5 says, be content. Here's the word, satisfied. Listen, I'm never satisfied in my relationship with God. I'm always wanting to press on. I'm never just there. I'm always wanting to move on in my relationship with God. But in terms of money, in terms of material things, be content, he says. Be content. You're not born content. Look at a baby. Not content. Rarely content, right? Always something, right? So we don't come into this world naturally content. We have our moments. But it doesn't take much for the circumstances to change, right? Contentment is satisfied no matter what the circumstances are. That's contentment. Satisfied with my circumstances. That's what we're talking about. I had you turn, and I want you to go here with me, Philippians 4. I had you look at that earlier. I want you to go back there. I'm not going to look at the whole passage. I'm just going to try to show you a few things here about contentment in that passage. I love this passage. I started to do the whole sermon on this passage, but just decided there was other things I wanted to talk about. So, but this is good. This is Paul in Philippians chapter 4. Paul is in prison. I told you earlier, he is in prison, and he has received a gift, a financial gift, from the Philippian church. And he's writing back to the Philippians, thanking them for this gift, okay? He's in prison, receiving this gift. He's writing them back. That's what the book of Philippians is. And he's responding to them and talks all about joy through that whole letter, as we talked earlier. But in verse 11, he says, not that I speak from want, 4:11, not that I speak from want, not that I speak from wanting or needing something, for I have learned, notice, to be content, satisfied in whatever circumstances I am. Notice, I've learned that. Doesn't say I wasn't born this way. I've learned that. I've learned to be content in whatever circumstances I'm in. Circumstances do not dictate my contentment, is what he's saying. Here's some ways he learned it. Verse 12, I know how to get along with humble means, with very little, and I also know how to live in prosperity. I mean, Paul, at one time in his life, he was probably on the Sanhedrin, probably a very respected teacher in Judaism, a Pharisee, so very wealthy at one time, and maybe he's experienced other times of, you know, prosperity in that sense. But his point is, I've lived at different spectrums, at different ends of this have and have not type thing. And in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry. I know what it's like to be full when you go to bed at night. I know what it's like to be hungry when you go to bed at night. I've experienced that. I've been stretched in all directions on this. And the one consistent thing that's been there every time is the strength of Christ. See that in verse 13? We use verse 13 sometime if we want to, you know, do good in some sporting event. Or I'm going to walk in there and take that exam, and I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You know, we're quoting that verse over and over again. It's on our wall. It's on a verse card in front of us while we're going through trying to do something. Well, that's not what the verse is talking about. Nice try. But the point is, this is what it's talking about. How have I been sustained in all of these events, in all of these trials, in all of these prosperity and humble means? How have I been sustained in all that? It's Christ. I can do anything. I can go through any of these things because Christ strengthens me. My circumstances may change, but it's Christ who strengthens me. See that? The key to joy is not improving my circumstances. It's Christ. Christ. You think, if I could just change the circumstances, if I could just have more, I would be happy and I would be content. No, contentment does not come from your circumstances, and money is not going to satisfy you. You won't be content. Christ is who makes us content. It's Him. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me and teaches me to be content, who helps me to be content in those circumstances. And you're going to see this in chapter 13, verse 8. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. My circumstances may change, but Christ never changes. That's pretty neat. That's pretty neat. That's where contentment is. Here's some ways you know you're not content. You're sitting in this sermon today and you're not content, I know. I'm not. I wasn't all that content preparing it. I kept thinking how convicting all this was. But are you constantly thinking or talking or worrying about money? Do you constantly think and talk and worry about money? This is how you know you're not content. Because the mouth speaks from that which fills the heart. You know you're not content. You know there's a dissatisfaction because I'm always talking about it. I'm always worrying about it. I'm always thinking about it. Here's another way you know you're not content. Do you envy other people? Do you envy family members? Do you envy friends who have more than you do? Do you? This is hard. I understand this. See, that's a symptom of discontent. Envy. Envy. You see, it leads to another sin. It leads to another sin, jealousy and envy. Are you constantly thinking about things you would like to own? You know, Colossians 3:2 says, set your mind on things above, not on the things that are on the earth. And understand something. TV commercials are designed to make you discontent. That's how they're designed. You will never brush your teeth with the right toothpaste, you will never use the right deodorant, and you will never drive the right car, ever. They will not let you get away with that. They are seeking to make you as discontent as possible so you will buy. what was that show? Lifestyle of the Rich and Famous? What was that all about? I mean, I just can't believe people live like that, but I guess they're out there. But the point is, what does that do? There's something lacking in you. There's something about you and me that's just not right, that we don't have all that, or we don't have these things, and just creates discontent. Are you, do you use material things like a drug? Like a drug. I'm lonely. I'm bored. I'm sad. I'm going to go to the mall. I'm going to go to the mall. That'll fix it. I'm going to go buy something. It's true. I love this verse that goes along with that thought. Everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. Come to the waters. It's free, says. It's free. It's free. You don't have to have any money. Just come to the water and drink. And then he says in verse 2 of Isaiah 55, why do you spend money for what is not bread and your wages for what does not satisfy? See, our whole economy thrives on discontentment. You understand that? In fact, if you apply anything I say today, our economy will collapse. It will. Our whole economy will collapse because it's built on discontentment. As long as you and I are discontent, our economy will boom. Now, I'm not against our economy by any means, but I'm biblical. I want to be biblical. And I'm concerned about our testimony to the world. Are you a compulsive shopper? These are just ways to show discontent. Are you in financial trouble? Do you have debt because of your spending habits? Are you spending more than you get? That's discontentment. I read somewhere that average family, it's probably, some numbers could have changed, this, I don't know how old this is, but average family has $10,000 in credit card debt, of which they're paying twice of what the amount of what they, the cost of what they purchased something because of interest and all of that on top of it. The Bible calls that a bondage. It calls it the borrower becoming the lender's slave when we take on that kind of debt. Let me wrap this up. How do you grow in contentment? I think first thing you recognize, this is not a money problem. Understand that is not a money problem. This is a heart problem. This is a contentment problem in us, in me. The love of money in verse 13:5, the love of money is the enemy of contentment. The love of money is the enemy of contentment. I got to do something about the love of money. I got to attack that in my heart. You got to realize that raising your standard of living is not the answer. It's lowering your desires. That passage in 1 Timothy also has this in there. Listen to this. For we brought nothing into the world, so we can take nothing out of it either. We brought nothing into the world. We can't take anything out of it. There's no pockets on shrouds. As I heard somebody say, there's not. You can't take anything out. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. Think about that. Food and covering. Covering takes the whole idea of shelter and clothing. We shall be content. Everything else is excess. Everything else is just extra. He says, we can be content with just those things. That's interesting. It almost pulls us back to a simplicity, doesn't it? To something a little simpler than what we might be pursuing when you think about it. But the point is, it's not wrong to have things, but it's important to understand that we can be content with so much less than what we have. Our lives just get complicated when we add more to it. I think we all agree with that. But the point is that every want I have is not a need. Every want I have is not a need. I need to ask myself that. Is this really a need? Do I really, really need this? Acknowledge that God is sovereign over your life, where he's got you. What does John the Baptist say to the Roman soldiers who come up to him while he's at baptizing? And he says that they were questioning him. And what about us? What shall we do? The Roman soldiers ask. And he says, do not take money from anyone by force or accuse anyone falsely, and be content with your wages. Interesting, he says that to them. Be content with your wages. This is where God has sovereignly placed you. Be content with what you receive. Wow. I heard Alcorn say this. I listened to him yesterday. Alcorn said, he said, Americans are in the top 10% of the wealthiest people in the world, and even our poorest among us in our society are in the top 15% of the wealthiest people in the world. Just compare that. Just think about the rest of the world. Don't grumble. Philippians 2, do not grumble. Grumbling is, people, and he uses the illustration there of going back into the wilderness when the people were grumbling against Moses. You know who they were really mad at? They were really mad at God. They were really mad at God for bringing them out in the wilderness, but Moses was the one they could get to. They couldn't get to God, so they got to Moses. But they were grumbling, and God judged them. God, grumbling is an attack on God, attack on his sovereignty, an attack on his goodness, his grace in our lives. When we grumble, we're unthankful. And that's one I would say to you today also, is cultivate thankfulness. It's hard for discontented people to be thankful. This week we're going to go through the motions of Thanksgiving. A lot of discontented people are going to be saying they're thankful, but really in their heart they're unsatisfied. Unsatisfied. Because discontented people have a difficult time being thankful. They grumble, they complain, they want more. They don't have enough. In everything, give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. If you're going to truly celebrate a Thanksgiving time together this week, to be truly thankful, it's a heart that is free from the love of money. Free. Don't be proud of what you've been given. Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited. Express your faith by giving. Some people maybe didn't grow up watching how giving is done, but you know what? Giving, maybe you didn't grow up in a church and you saw your parents give, but giving is the greatest attack on our selfishness of anything we do in worship. It really is. We give. It's an act of worship. It's an act of expressing gratitude to God for what he has done. Placing my treasure in heaven, not on this earth, where rust and moths destroy, but it's putting my treasure in heaven. It's being rich toward God. See, when your heart, where your heart is, where your money is, folks, I encourage you to give. We don't do stewardship things here. I'm not into all that. I'm not into saying a lot about giving. We don't talk about that a lot here. You understand that. But I'm not ashamed of saying it to you either. You are to give. You are not receiving, you are to be giving. Giving. God blesses us in that. Honor the Lord from your wealth and from the first of all your produce, so your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. God blesses you in that. So much to say. No more time. I got to read Luke 12 to you, but we have an evening service in a few minutes, and so I don't want to do that. Luke 12 is good. I'll pick that up next week. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much. Thank you for this time. Hard subject, Father. But you know, God, we can walk out here today knowing that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. That you're the one that can give us true contentment. You're the one that can help us to have joy deep in our inner being. That you can free us from covetousness. It's in every one of us in this room. There's not a one of us that this is not a problem for. Father, I just ask you to help us. Help us to allow you to attack this in us, that we'll be a people who love, a people who give, a people who trust you, not riches. We'll be a people who are free from the love of money, free from the love of our things. That we will have treasure in heaven, and our heart, because our heart is there, Oh God, give us that kind of heart. I pray you'll work in us to do that. In Jesus' name, amen.